From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Doug Nichols' documentary project began because from time to time he would look over at an old Underwood typewriter in the corner of his office. It didn't work. It was more like a piece of art. Typewriters can be beautiful in a strange way. But Nichols said from time to time when he would look over at it, it was as if the old machine was calling to him to get it repaired and make it useful. And that's what led him to California Typewriter, a shop in Berkeley, one of the last in the country that fixes them. That's how it started, his film about typewriters and the people who work on them and collect them and use them. It's also about that constant conflict between the draw of the past and the possibilities of the future. We're screening Doug Nichols' film next week, talking about it after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They're one of 24 children's hospitals in the country that's been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for providing excellent care in all 10 pediatric specialties. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Sure, there's a nostalgic appeal to a typewriter. They're well-built and supremely functional. It's the ultimate analog artifact. But that's not all Doug Nichols is after in his documentary film about the typewriter. There's history in here and obsession. One of the themes is the conflict between the ongoing rush of digital technology and the more methodical pace of using a mechanical tool. He even explores the physicality of the typewriter, how it is a crucial part of the creative process for writers and artists. At its heart, though, the film is also a story about one shop, one of the last, that repairs typewriters. It's a shop in Berkeley called California Typewriter. It's also the name of Nichols' film, which we're going to be screening next Tuesday as part of our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Today in the program, Doug Nichols is joining us to talk about it. He directed, produced, edited, served as cinematographer for the film. He's joining us today from a studio in Marin County, California. And Doug Nichols, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I guess I wanted to begin. I've read where you have described being drawn to the subject in kind of a mysterious way. I thought we'd start there. What do you mean, kind of a mysterious way?
Well, the film happened really by chance. One day I just got this inkling to buy a typewriter, and I found one on eBay, an old Underwood I found for $6. And I bought it really just to have as an object of art to sit in the corner of my office. So I got it. It arrived. And as it sat there, you know, for the next few weeks, it kind of drew me over to it. And I'd go over and push the keys, and they wouldn't work. And so I decided to fix it up, and I Googled typewriter shops, and I could only find this one left in San Francisco that was over in Berkeley. Yeah. And I took it over there, met the guys at California Typewriter, and I thought it could be a nice little short film. And they were really struggling, so I made this short to try to help them out, you know, put it on YouTube, bring them some business. And then a friend got it to Tom Hanks, and he liked it, and he said, "Hey, I'll be in it," and it kind of just grew organically from there. I started following people who were using typewriters. I hung out at the shop and met very interesting people, and it was just a labor of love that I made over a 5-year period.
So you weren't exactly sure where this thing was headed. I mean, it was sort of the story of the shop, but then I guess it sort of built momentum and then would head in one direction. So you weren't really in control, it seems like, at first.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much did it all on my own. You know, I shot it, directed, edited, did the sound. And I make a living as a commercials director. So it was a personal project I was doing between my commercials work. Mm-hmm. You know, so I come home to San Francisco after filming in Europe somewhere and work on it for a while. And I just made it really for the joy of making it. I didn't know where it was heading. But I did an experiment where I just kind of listened to what the film wanted to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I just decided, you know, I'm paying for it myself. I don't have to finish it. So I followed it where it led me.
Yeah. I want to talk about the kind of literary beginning of the piece. This is from this art project, I guess it was 1967, about this thing that happened in 66. Talk a little bit about this story. It's just a little bit that we see at the beginning, but there's a kind of literary flair to it, which is kind of what the film is about. It has this kind of literary jazz kind of quality. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about that Royal Road Test.
Right. Well, you know, hanging out at the shop in Berkeley, one of the first people I met was after I met the family who repair typewriters, and they try to keep typewriters going. I met Jeremy Mayer, who's an artist who destroys typewriters. He takes them apart and turns them into art objects. So I met him, and he told me, you know, we struck up a friendship, and he told me about the Royal Road Test, which is an art piece that Ed Ruscha, Mason Williams, and Patrick Blackwell made in 1966. We're coming back from Las Vegas. They, you know, Mason was sitting in the passenger seat of the car, and there was a typewriter at his feet, and he didn't have any room. So he decided to throw it out the window. So they threw this typewriter out the window at 90 miles an hour and exploded all over the desert. And after driving about 20 miles, he and Ed Ruscha said, why don't we go back and photograph that? It was almost like a kind of a crime scene, yeah. You know, like examine it like a crime scene. So that was the beginning of one of their early art books.
It turns out there are a number of, surprisingly, good number of art projects with typewriters. I mean, some of them appear, of course, you mentioned Jeremy Mayer, whom we'll get back to. But what do you figure is the connection between art and typewriters? Because it seems like there is one.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's a very tactile thing. So it's like picking up a paintbrush and painting. And, you know, with a typewriter, you can really, you know, it's much like a bicycle where you can look at it and see exactly how it works. You know, you push a button. Mm-hmm. It sends a key to a piece of paper and it imprints a letter. So it's not like, you know, in these days, like your computer where you hit a key and you don't know what happens. You know, you don't know how that works. But with a typewriter, you can really see it. So I think these days for a lot of artists, they're, you know, returning to that kind of analog sensibility and they like that. So, yes, there are people who play music on it, people who draw with it. There's a woman I shot. She's not in the film, but she lives in England and she uses a typewriter as a like a sketch pad, you know. So yeah. There's a lot of different uses for it.
Let's talk about Herb Permillion and his family. This is, of course, as you mentioned, this is the thing that got you started with all of this. They own California Typewriters. He bought it, I think you say in the film, in the 1980s. What is the appeal for Herb and typewriters? Why is this so meaningful for him?
Well, you know, Herb has an interesting story. You know, it's kind of a weird thing. In constructing this film, it had so many tangential, you know, areas that it went into, and I had to rein it back in to make a film, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Herb's story is really interesting. He started out working for IBM, and he was repairing all the typewriters on the Berkeley campus back in the 60s. So, you know, he was repairing Ted Kaczynski's typewriter, who he became the Unabomber, you know. And he was repairing – so he put on a coat and tie and he would repair all the Berkeley typewriters. And then in night, he would go and repair the typewriters at the Black Panther party. So Bobby Seals and those guys, their typewriters.
Wow.
So he basically loved typewriters. And he finally – you know, he's working. And then finally he decided to put up the money and buy his own shop. Well, he bought this just around the time that Apple released the first personal computer. So he bought it, you know, he bought it at a wrong time, but he loved what he did, and he just kept doing it, you know, hanging on through the 80s and 90s, all the way up to when I met him, you know, around the late 2000s.
Yeah. Let me play a moment here. This is, as Herb's daughter Carmen says, Herb has a dream that people are going to come back to typewriters.
My dad believes that there are various people all over the place totally excited about typewriters. I think he thinks it's somewhat of a wave of the future, that the more people are going to come back to them just for different reasons. He's hopeful, for sure. And he's willing to spend his last dime.
Yeah, he's committed. And I won't give too much away, but I mean, that is the question, whether or not the shop is going to make it. But I guess it's his passion. His and Ken's, Ken Alexander, whom we should also talk a little bit about, he is... I don't know. In some ways, he's kind of, to me, was sort of the heart of the film in some ways.
Yeah, I found with Ken, you know, I started at the shop. There are the three main characters. There's Ken, Herb, who's the boss who owns the shop, and then Carmen, his daughter.
Yeah.
And I interviewed each of them, and I just found that Ken did the best job of communicating their desires and their hopes. And he has a great voice, too. He should be a radio announcer.
Yeah.
But I decided to follow him because he didn't own the shop. He was an employee, and his whole livelihood depended upon that shop. You know, I mean, Herb can always sell the shop and make the money from the building. But if they close, you know, Ken's out on the street, you know, and he's got nothing. So he was very endearing to me, and I followed him as the main character.
One thing that I noticed, Herb is from New Orleans. He comes from a line of jazz musicians, and it's kind of one of the characters, one of the musical characters in the film, jazz music.
Exactly. Like I said, this whole project is one that I didn't script out. I didn't sit down and plan it and make it. I just really listened to what the film wanted to be. So when I made that first little 3-minute piece that I ended up getting to Tom Hanks, I was just listening to music, and I came upon Stolen Moments by the Ahmad Jamal Trio. And it just fit, you know. I just dropped it in. And that kind of became the theme song for that story. So I used jazz music throughout the film for the California typewriter story. And then I used, for the two other stories which form the film, I used different kinds of music really to separate the three into three different stories that you could follow. And the music kind of, you know, exemplified that in a way.
Yeah. When did you learn that Tom Hanks was such a typewriter, you know, fanatic?
Well, you know, when I started it, I did go on the internet and type in typewriters and who was interested. And there was a website I found that had all the famous people who, you know, use typewriters and their typewriters, and then people still using them today. So I did discover, you know, that Tom had an affinity for them. And, I reached out to him through a friend who was working with his wife on a script. And and then through Tom, I got to David McCullough.
Yeah.
And that led on to Sam Shepard and John Mayer.
It's like he lights up, Tom Hanks, when he talks about typewriters. And it's like he is showing you them. And, I mean, it's a really – he's really into it.
Yeah. When I filmed him, he had 270 typewriters. And through the making of the film, I've got like 85 now, which is kind of crazy. I started with the one. But, he's the guy – he uses them – he's really into Smith Coronas, like 1950s Smith Coronas. And he just loves them, and he uses them to write letters. He does all his correspondence on them. He writes notes to people. So he uses typewriters as a tool, and he's always looking for new ones, and he gives them away.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's totally into them.
Here's a moment from the film. Here's Tom Hanks.
I've tried to foster a community of typewriting people, and it hasn't quite worked. I've given typewriters to folks because I have a lot of spares. And if somebody says, geez, I'd like to have a typewriter write letters, it's on their desk within 48 hours with a note from me explaining the typewriter to them. I go to their houses later on. They have it up on a shelf somewhere like it's an object of art. And I say, get that bad boy down. Put it on your desk. Have it right there so you can always type something to somebody. I type almost every day. There's usually a memo that I'm sending to somebody or a question or a thank you note or an actual response. I hate getting email thank yous from folks. Hey, we had a great time last night, you know, or hey, I really appreciate you doing that. So really, you appreciated it so much that you took 7 seconds to send me an email. Now, if they take 70 seconds to type me out something on a piece of paper and send it to me, well, I'll keep that forever. Otherwise, I just delete that email.
Seems like this is a theme in the film, Doug Nichol, that the idea that this is, I mean, this was you. You know, you just sort of stared at this object of art for a while in your office, and it was kind of calling for you because it had a practical use. That seems like that's the appeal for Hanks and a lot of other people, is it's a useful thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, John Mayer says toward the end of the film, it's like, for him, he has a lot of guitars, right? And his favorite guitar is this one, well, at least when I shot him, was a 1950-something Stratocaster. And he just said, you know, the guitar really never got better than that. And in a way, he said the same thing about typewriter. Like, you know, as just a tool that puts your ideas from your head down onto a piece of paper in the fastest way. You don't have to turn it on or whatever, and makes them permanent. You know, a typewritten page will last for thousands of years if you keep it out of the sunlight. So, you know, it is still a tool. And, you know, like, and he says that. He says, like, write a book on a typewriter and promote it on Twitter. You know, you don't have to give something, you don't have to throw something good away if it's still working for you.
Yeah. I liked how John Mayer talks about the way the typewriter works in the creative context. He saw this, that Pennebaker documentary of Bob Dylan, and that really got him thinking about it, and it really inspired him. Would you just talk a little bit about this moment? Because it's great. I mean, we get to see an excerpt from that film and Dylan actually typing up the lyrics of a song on a typewriter.
Yeah, I think he saw that. He went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and saw the typewritten lyrics, and realizing that most of his lyrics up to that point had been typed into a computer and they're somewhere in the cloud. So he liked the idea of actually having something tangible. And he now has since that time used the typewriter to write his ideas. So he just sits down and kind of goes stream of consciousness, gets those ideas out without anything interrupting it, without spell check or grammar check interrupting it. Then he can look at those pages and circle words and link them together, and then they eventually form his songs. So I think, yes, he was inspired by seeing, you know, Bob Dylan in the clip in the film. He's sitting down using the typewriter almost as a musical instrument.
Here's John Mayer.
I instantly started to really come alive on it. And I realized the reason that I was able to come alive on a typewriter where I wasn't using a computer or even a pen was that you're at sort of a safe distance where you can express yourself openly without having to edit yourself at the same time. And so it became this sort of like confessional for me where I would sit and just type. And the reason that I was able to go deeper into an idea was because I wasn't stopped anywhere in that writing by a red squiggly line. And what is spell check or grammar check if all you're really trying to do is sort of dig into this sort of mercurial sort of world of what your ideas are?
So interesting, he sort of talks about this process of fighting through a song on a typewriter and how you can see the way the any songwriter, I guess, who's typing on a typewriter is working through it. The stuff that you ditch, the stuff that you keep, but there it is on a piece of paper.
Exactly. I think, you know, for him, what he would do is keep a typewriter set up on a table with a piece of paper in it. And, you know, he might be in his place coming back from a party or whatever, and he could just sit down and immediately just the ideas would start flowing out. He didn't have to sit down, flip the switch on, wait for it to boot up, then type it, and then be hit with all those little squiggly lines, like, you know, making him go back and correct words, interrupting his stream of consciousness or his thought process. So, yeah, I mean, that's for him is the joy of using a typewriter, I think.
Has it changed your process at all? I'm not sure if you write out, you know, film concepts or your journal or anything on a typewriter these days, but I'm wondering has it influenced the way you work?
For me, from making the movie, like I said, I started with the one Underwood.
Yeah.
And then I had to buy typewriters. Let's say I shot Tom Hanks, but I needed close-ups of the keys, so I had to find that same model. So I did that. And just through the course of making the film and meeting people, I ended up, you know, getting all these typewriters. And I have one set up that I really like in my office. And I just keep, and I actually write letters to people, which I really enjoy the process of writing, sitting down, just writing a letter, even with all of the mistakes and, you know, going back and X-ing out words. It's a nice thing, you know, because you can just be alone with your thoughts and this machine that's not making any, you know, it's not like on, you don't hear the power button or anything.
Yeah. That trance-like state is another theme in the film that people get to when they're typing something out.
Yeah, I think there's Sam Shepard talks about the rhythm keeping his, you know, his writing going, that, you know, the percussion, you know, of the typewriter keys kind of driving the words. And there, that comes to another theme in the film, which is, you know, the question of when you sit down at a typewriter, where are the ideas? You know, are the ideas coming to you? I mean, are the keys working you, or are you working the keys? You know,
Sam Shepard, he's interesting this moment in the film, I have to say, because he's he's a solitary figure. I mean, he likes the idea of being alone. And I'm wondering if you've identified a type, people who like typewriters, if they're it seems like in some ways they're all over the map, people who like this analog experience of a typewriter. But I do wonder if that solitary figure is a type that likes them too.
Well, you know what I found from making this film is that people who like typewriters are real individuals. They aren't part of the sheep mentality. You know, I think there's a whole part of the world. Everybody loves to just follow along, you know. So you go on Facebook and, you know, everybody likes to think the same way or whatever. And I found that people, you know, who use typewriters are just really totally individuals, you know, who just do their own thing and don't really care what anyone else thinks. And that's why I was kind of attracted to, you know, all the people in the film. I really, they're very endearing to me.
Here's another moment. This is Sam Shepard. He's talking about his relationship with his typewriter, which in this moment from the film he describes as a creature you have to care for.
I just never got along with the computer screen. It's somehow removed from the tactile experience, you know. When you go to ride a horse, you have to saddle it. When you use a typewriter, you have to feed it paper. There's a percussion about it. You can see the ink flying onto the surface of the paper. So a letter will go, bam, like that. But along with it is the ink kind of flying into the paper. I'd rather ride a horse than drive a car. But that puts you in a very different relationship to the modern world, you know.
It's from Doug Nichols' documentary film California Typewriter, which we're going to be screening next Tuesday night. That's November 21st. We're going to be at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. It's part of our Through the Lens series, of course, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Doug Nichols and typewriter repairman Ken Alexander are going to join us by Skype for a Q&A after the film. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We're going to take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about typewriters. The filmmaker Doug Nichols has made a documentary that's an homage to the typewriter, really to mechanical things. Tom Hanks uses a typewriter. He's in the film. The musician John Mayer, too. He's also in the film. So is the playwright Sam Shepard, among others. And not just because of sentimentality, by the way. They don't see these things as objects of art. They see them as tools. A typewriter is a tool. The way it's designed, the way it's used, makes you write and think differently. We're going to be screening the film next week. We'll give you details about that. Doug Nichols is joining us today to talk about the film. Let's talk about Martin Howard. He's a great character. I guess he's a collector, kind of obsessed in some ways. How did you meet him?
Yeah, I mean, I love Martin. He brings a lot of the humor to the film. I met, as I told you, the sculptor Jeremy Mayer early on, and he was kind of my conduit to a lot of interesting things, to the Royal Road Test, to different, you know, he told me about Boston Typewriter Orchestra. And then he told me about this collector. He said, you got to go to Canada and shoot Martin Howard because he has the greatest collection of old typewriters, you know, the very, very early designs, the first ones that were ever made. So I got in touch with Martin, flew up there. And he was just such a fascinating character. He's retained his childhood, excitement for life, and he was just so fun to be around, and he's so funny, naturally funny.
Yeah, his relationship with his father is in here. Is how he's trying to kind of conjure up the past in some ways, chasing the past. That seems like a theme here too. Like people, one of the things that's appealing for a typewriter, for some of us anyway, is that it's connected to stuff in the past.
Yeah, well, the film for me, it's three stories. And one is Martin's story. It's about the past. He's searching for not only his own past and his childhood, but he's searching for the origins of the typewriter and for this very rare Scholes and Glidden, the very first typewriter ever made.
Yeah.
And then I have Jeremy's story on the other end, which is about a guy looking totally toward the future and destroying typewriters and turning them into these objects that, you know, where he sees us going, turning into, you know, android kind of half machine, half human characters. Then the present story was the California typewriter story about the shop and just people trying to survive in the present, you know, doing what they love with repairing these typewriters.
Yeah. There's a moment in the section about Martin when he has he's talking with a collector who has, I don't know, 12, 20 something of these Scholl's and Scholl and Glidden typewriters. I mean, it's the grail. This is what Martin wants more than anything. And this guy has a bunch of them. They're just in boxes, some of them anyway. And he's trying to conjure up the he's trying to just sort of screw up the courage to ask this guy if he'll sell him one. I don't know. It's just kind of a funny, kind of sad moment in some way.
Yeah, it was a funny scene because Martin wants just one Scholl's and Glidden.
Yeah.
You know, it's the holy grail of typewriters. And this guy has 12 of them. So, you know, that's always how it is in life. You know, like one guy has more than he needs and one guy just wants the one. Yeah, so Martin, you know, he came and found the collector and tried to see if he could make a deal. But a lot of these guys, they just want to hold on to them. They never want to share their machines.
Yeah. Darren Weschler, the writer, you feature him in the film, and he talks about this interesting idea that I hadn't really heard that much about, and that is the idea of a typewriter coming around, the technology. At the same time, there was all this spiritual stuff going on. And so he kind of introduces, and I wanted you to have you say something about this idea of that the typewriter is somehow, you know, haunted, or, you know, that in there's something kind of spiritual about at least this time in history.
Yeah, I think when those objects, you know, it was a short period of time where a lot of things were invented at the same time, which is the, you know, you had the telegraph, you had the typewriter, you had motion pictures, you had still photography, you had audio recording. There's so many things that happened at this period. It was like the late 1800s. And I think a lot of people, you know, thought, wow, there's some, you know, would it be possible maybe with this, all this advancement in technology to communicate to the other world, to communicate with the dead? And so people, you know, they had seances and things. And some people looked at the typewriters wondering if when they sat down at it, you know, was it the dead speaking through them or you know, I don't know if I'm making any sense.
But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, Darren he communicates that really, really well. But, you know, like the author Paul Auster, who I'd wanted to film, he sometimes believes that when he sits down, he doesn't know whether, you know, who's pulling the strings. Is he writing? Is it coming from him or is it coming through him? You know, I think that's an interesting idea about all creativity, whether it comes from us or it comes through us.
Well, I think that was one of the most striking things for me about the film, and this kind of comes up. John Mayer, I think, talks a little bit about it. It seems like
Sam Shepard as well.
Sam Shepard as well.
Together,
yeah. This idea that the process of and this is where it's different, I think, from a digital experience of writing something out on a computer, on a word processor. For some reason, I'm not sure why that is, but the creative process is different because it must be that you're using your brain in a different way because you're also physically negotiating the machine too, it seems.
Yeah, it's mysterious. It's the part I really like that scene in the film where they, you know, both John and Sam talk about creativity and that you know, that it doesn't come from you, it comes through you. And, you know, it's like you have to be there in the right moment and then you see it. You see it as a vision and then you try to capture that before it disappears. You know, you try to get that out on a piece of paper or pick up a guitar and try to translate whatever you're seeing or feeling, you know, into art. And, you know, because, yeah, I believe that as well. I don't believe things come from you. I think they come through you. I even felt that making this movie. I didn't feel like, you know, I just felt like I was the shepherd kind of like guiding it into what it was trying to be. And that's why I really listened to what the film wanted to be. And it led me to people and places and, you know, It was a very interesting process.
There's a poet in the film, Sylvie Alcivar.
Yeah, Alcivar.
Alcivar. Let me play a little moment here. Maybe you can set this up for us. The thing that she does is she goes out and she interacts with people. And I guess based on it seems like just this short experience that she has with someone, she types up, a little poem for them.
Yeah, she said she has a Red Royal typewriter that she bought from a man who had lost his wife. So the man's wife had used this typewriter every day for her whole life, and she died. And then Sylvie met him very soon afterwards, and he just felt that she had to have this typewriter. So she doesn't let anyone touch the typewriter. She's the only one who uses it. And she goes and she sets up her poetry stand different places in San Francisco, and she'll sit there, and people will come up and want to talk to her about their problems or their feelings or secrets that they have. And she will write a poem based upon what she's feeling from them. So and she doesn't think about it. She just lets it flow through her. Again, she feels whatever's happening is just coming through her. You know, she's channeling these ideas into little poems that she gives to people to help them.
I often think about what I do as counseling because people come to me with some big stuff. I write a lot of poems about death and about people who've died. I wrote a poem for a man who had lost his wife 3 months ago, and they'd been married for 43 years. And when he made his request, he could barely talk. Somebody's desire for words sometimes is a desire for something more. A man had gone to the Golden Gate Bridge to jump and was saved by the police. And so he wanted me to write him a poem that was about his secret nobody in his life knew. I was so grateful to him for unloading it on me.
And Sylvie says in the film, this was interesting, she said, if you were to ask her to speak a poem, she couldn't really do it. But somehow the experience of writing it on a typewriter makes that different. I wonder what that is, what the difference is for her.
I think, you know, she sets up the typewriter, she puts her fingers on those keys, and it just starts working,
yeah.
You know. And a number of people, she's not the only one, a lot of people say they sit down, they touch the keys, and things come to them, they just start pushing them because they want to push it, you know, that tactile feeling, that percussion, that the music that they create by, making the sounds in the typewriter drives the ideas through them. So, you know, John Mayer feels that. Tom Hanks, Sam Shepard talked about it. It's an interesting thing.
She says
mysterious.
She says it's the love of her life, that typewriter.
Yeah. It is a beautiful typewriter.
Yeah, it is.
And she doesn't let anyone use it. And she makes her living from it. And it changed her life. You know, when she bought that typewriter from that guy in San Francisco, she didn't know what she just arrived in town. She didn't know what she wanted to do. And she became a poet from it, you know. So that getting that typewriter changed her life in an interesting way.
You meet one person who leads you to another story and then to another story. At somewhere down the line, you came in contact with the writer David McCullough. And this is a part of the film where, and it's expressed by Ken Alexander, that a typewriter in some ways symbolizes hard work. Would you say something about that? That was an interesting twist.
Yeah. Ken talks about when he takes the typewriter apart and, you know, fixes them, repairs them for people. He really sees the kind of America. You know, I don't know if it's just. It was a dream or something, but the America that, you know, that was based on hard work and people who really, you know, got out there and built the country, and, you know, with their bare hands. So he sees all that work in the typewriter. And David McCullough said the happiest people he knows in his life are the people who get up every day and work hard. And the people that he knows in his life who are the most unhappy are the people who have a lot of money and have everything done for them. So for him, hard work the joy of life is working, is doing your craft, doing what you like.
Yeah.
It isn't like sitting around on vacation all the time. So you know, having something to do brings life meaning, you know. And I think the way the world's going with technology is it's making everything so easy. You know, it's making soon you won't have to drive your car. Truck drivers won't need to, you know, drive trucks anymore. Your garbage will be picked up by kind of automated robots. You know, everything. So many jobs are going to disappear, and then people won't have much to do. So it's kind of like, what kind of world are we creating? A world without work, but will that bring happiness to people?
Yeah.
You know, that's a big question.
Here's another moment from the film. This is David McCullough.
People tell me that I could do much better. I could go faster and have less to contend with if I were to use a computer, a word processor. But I don't want to go faster. If anything, I would prefer to go slower. To me, it's understandable. I press the key, and another key comes up and prints a letter on a piece of paper. And then you can pull it out. It's a piece of paper upon which you have printed something. You've made that. It's tangible. It's real. I think the tool of the typewriter, because it is more difficult, produces for me a better result.
David McCullough from Doug Nichols' film California Typewriter, which we're going to be screening next Tuesday evening at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series. It's our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Doug Nichols and typewriter repairman Ken Alexander are going to be joining us via Skype for a Q&A after the film. I'll just point out it's at the library, so seating is limited. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with filmmaker Doug Nichols. We're talking about his documentary, California Typewriter, which we're going to be screening next Tuesday night. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. He's joining us from a studio in Marin County, California.
Hey.
So let me ask you, Doug Nichols, because we have to play a little bit from the Boston Typewriter Orchestra. Talk about this group. It's just a little section in the film, but I really liked it, and it gave you a sense of the kind of the musicality of typewriters.
Yeah, I love these guys. They're really eccentric, and when I came across them, I thought, you know, I heard this song they did called Entropy Begins in the Office, and it's all done with typewriters, and they just, you know, it's five people, and they play everything on a typewriter. I just thought I added that scene in. It comes at a certain point in the film where you need a little bit of a lift maybe, and it changes direction. But they were fun to do. I came from a background of making music videos, so I kind of made like a little bit of a slight music video within the film.
One of the more kind of personal parts of the film is Jeremy Mayer. You've already referred to him. He's this artist. And it's in some ways, it's a profile of his life, certainly where he begins growing up, you know, in a rural area, really in the mountains for a time, and then coming to the city. Talk a little bit about Jeremy Mayer, because he's a really important character in the film, and he represents this interest and maybe even concern about the future, but also about the potential for the way you can make typewriter parts look like beautiful things.
Yeah, it was a very interesting thing meeting Jeremy, because when I'm at the beginning of the film, you know, the Permillions who own the shop, they were trying to keep the typewriter going, you know, finding these old typewriters, fixing them up and putting them for sale and trying to make a little money off of it. And Jeremy, who was a customer of the shop, he would help. He met these guys. He did the opposite. He would take typewriters, take them completely apart like an Erector set, and reassemble them into human figures, kind of android figures that represented his feeling about where we're heading as we're going to turn into, you know, half man, half machine kinds of things. And it was interesting in the film because I met him right – he had no money. He was sleeping on the floor of a shipping container in Oakland in a sleeping bag, had no money to his name. And through the course of the film, his work catches on with people from Silicon Valley, and you know, he makes a sculpture of Mark Zuckerberg, and which is sitting now in Mark Zuckerberg's office. And I was lucky enough to get, you know, an artist from just starting, well, you know, when he had nothing until now his sculptures are selling for like six figures, and he's giving TED Talks and, you know, making sculptures in India and Paris. And so it was interesting to get that arc of an artist's career taking off like that.
Yeah. Here's Jeremy Mayer from the film.
When I take the typewriters apart, I don't see this unnatural object. But I see people, I see us in them. Very often near the platen knobs, there's a spot where someone's finger has rubbed across the carriage. And it's this one nice and shiny polished spot with a little bit of dirt and oil from the fingers. I like that kind of thing that's left on the typewriter. I could say that there's probably that person's DNA. It's fun to see those traces of people.
It's such an emotional machine. A lot of memories and a lot of real people put themselves onto a piece of paper through the machine. And I understand all that. This is how I choose to appreciate the typewriter, by dissecting it and bringing out the little bits and pieces that are us in them. So my favorite stuff to do is the human figures, because I find every curve on the human body in here somewhere, in one of these typewriters. And I like to try to put those together.
But this is the thing, though. He has to take him apart. And you see on one hand, Ken and Herb lovingly, carefully putting these machines back together. And in some cases, you see Jeremy, not violently, but pretty aggressively tearing them apart. It's a really interesting, just kind of visual and intellectual contrast, it seems, in the film.
Yeah, and they help each other, too.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, you know, when Ken and Herb are trying to repair a typewriter and they're looking for a certain, you know, a certain rubber roller or a certain spring for the typewriter, which they can't find, they call up Jeremy and he brings over all the boxes of parts, you know, all the pieces that he's taken apart, and he'll give them the ones they need to fix up an old typewriter. And, you know, Herb and Jeremy will go to the flea market together, and one of them's looking for ones that he can, you know, fix up and repair, and the other one's looking for ones he can destroy and turn into objects. And then what's interesting in the film, too, is that, you know, the shop was failing. They were about to close, and then Jeremy saves the shop by, you know, getting them all kind of up to date, you know, getting them a website, putting them online, getting them an Instagram account so that they're
able to reach
people.
Yeah, it's the ultimate irony, isn't it? I mean, they're using the technology that's essentially putting them out of business to maybe prolong their business for a while.
Yeah, they're saved through technology.
Yeah.
It's only the embrace of modern day that, you know, saves their shop, you know, because they need people to know about it. If you're not on the internet, nobody's going to know about you.
Jeremy gets hate mail. Like a lot of it. Pretty vociferous hate mail.
Yeah, there's a lot of people in the, you know, there's some typewriter collectors who just hate him. You know what I mean? They just think he's destroying, you know, ruining these typewriters. But, you know, there's millions of typewriters that still exist. There were so many that were made. And Jeremy doesn't take apart the good ones. He takes apart ones that are all rusty and can't be used again. So I think it's kind of unfair. Some people just give him a hard time for doing what he does. But he does it out of love.
Yeah. And here, let me play another moment, because he raises this really important question about whether we're going to become in the future, you know, as he puts it here, a different kind of human.
This is the way that I honor them. I'd much rather see them in this state than sitting on a shelf collecting dust. Technology will change us. We won't be human in the same way.
will be a different kind of human.
I wonder what you think, because this is one of the big questions, it seems, in the film. Jeremy says in the future that there's going to be this division between those who can harness this technology to improve their lives and those who are going to just reject it, you know, just want an analog life. Is that the image you see for the future? Do you agree with him?
Yeah, I think there's going to be the people, and you can already see it happening, the people who totally embrace the new technology and will start taking the technology into their bodies. They'll change their DNA. They'll, you know, incorporate chips into their brains or limbs or whatever, and they'll try to become a better, you know, what they see as a better human being. But they're just going to evolve. You know, technology is going to help us evolve one way.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be a group of people who don't want, you know, who are the people who really embrace analog in nature, and they're going to kind of reject that. So there's always a polarity, you know, like two poles with all this stuff, you know, with, you know, whether you're a Republican or you're a Democrat or you're this or that, you know, and there's going to be the people who embrace the future where technology is leading us, and then the people who will just try to have a simpler life living, you know, more of an analog existence.
Yeah.
And who, you know, it's like you've seen the movies like Terminator or whatever, you know, where the machines ultimately fight the, you know, what we become fights, you know, the people who try to remain as they were.
There's a academic in the film, Richard Polt. A lot of people may know him for this manifesto he wrote a while back about the typewriter, the typewriter revolution, as he calls it, and he's featured in the film. Let me play another moment. This is Richard Polt.
Typewriters are a so-called thing of the past, so people sometimes turn to them in an attempt to recapture the past.
How are we looking?
I think it looks good. I think it looks way better.
It's a way to travel back in time to a previous period in history. I've come to see typewriters less as objects of nostalgia than signs of a future, signs of something that's going to happen. There's a slow movement afoot. People realizing that not everything has to be completely efficient, not everything has to be goal-oriented, but you can enjoy the process itself. You could compare typing to the slow cooking movement. The point is not to eat as efficiently as possible. The point is to take your time. And efficiency is not the paramount value. The point is to enjoy what you're doing.
He talks about that fine line between having something help you and being dependent on it. It seems like that is absolutely the question we're asking ourselves now as we try to figure out what we're going to do with this technology.
Yeah, I agree. Things are there to help you, but it reaches a certain point where, you know, for instance, driving a car, right? I mean, it's fun to drive a car. It's fun to be in control. But there's going to be a point where self-driving cars will get so good that insurance companies won't allow you to drive your own car. And if you do, it's going to cost you tens of thousands of dollars to be able to drive your own car. And people will just give up. Who knows where that's going? Like, it comes back to my whole thing about work. It's fun to be able to do things. And as technology advances, it's all about making things more efficient and faster. And does that bring a better life? Does that make you happier? You know, if something takes a few seconds less time to achieve it? I mean, I don't know.
What's your favorite typewriter?
I got this one. It's called an Erika 10.
Erika 10?
Made in Germany. It's so beautiful, and I love the font on it. And, you know, part of this is the fonts, too. It's fun, you know, when you write a letter. A lot of them have different fonts. And for John Mayer, for instance, when I first shot him, he was using an Olympia. No, not Olympia. He was using a Brother typewriter. And then afterwards, he met Tom Hanks, and Tom said, you can't be using that. I got to send you an Olympia. So now he collects Olympias pretty much for the fonts because they got all kind of cool fonts, you know, different cursive or whatever. So, but my Erika has a really cool font and I like using it.
Let me play one more moment from the film because I want to ask you a question. This is from Tom Hanks.
Look, there's always going to be great watches that are made. You'll have to pay a premium for them. The truth is, no good typewriters are ever going to be made again. They're no matter how much of a premium you're going to want to pay for them, there's no factory, there's no businessman in the world who's going to open up a factory and says, we are going to make the finest typewriter that will last absolutely forever. And anybody who's willing to pay the $17,000 for a Hanks typewriter, they're going to pass it down to their... No, that's not going to... You might do that with a watch. You might do that. There'll always be a new iPad that's coming down the pike. There's always going to be good cars and things like that. But no one is ever going to make the great typewriter ever, ever, ever again. Boo-hoo.
Do you think he's right?
You know, I don't know. I mean, what's very funny is typewriter is really catching on. When I filmed the shop, they were about to close. And the new customers who started coming were kids who were dragging their parents and saying, I want a typewriter. So there's so many kids who are wanting typewriters and so many people who are wanting to disconnect, you know, are a little burnt out on technology and burnt out on Facebook and Instagram and all that kind of stuff. And they just want to, like, you know, unplug for a little while. So I don't know whether it's just a momentary kind of fad or whether it's a longer lasting thing. But yeah, there's more desire for typewriters and there's only so many of them that work. So the question is, will somebody step up and actually make one? You know, you can do that with 3D printing now. Yeah. They're scanning these old typewriters so they can actually, you know, easily create them. So who knows?
Yeah. Doug Nickel. You can see the film California Typewriter next Tuesday night. We're screening it at the Salt Lake City Main Downtown Library. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. Doug, of course, will join us via Skype. So will Ken Alexander. Seating is limited, so plan on arriving early.
Oh, just so you know, Jeremy's going to be there too, because we're going to do it from Jeremy's studio.
So. Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so the three of us will be there.
Perfect. All right. Well, we'll talk to you then. Those of you who want to get the details, go to our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey today, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.